Rick Steves'le birlikte seyahat edelim. That was Turkish 4, Less Traveled with Rick Steves. In Turkish again, Rick Steves'le birlikte seyahat edelim.
When I talk to people who've done a cross-country road trip, they often comment on how long it took to drive across the middle states in the United States, states like Nebraska, Kansas, and the Dakotas. The vastness of the Great Plains conceals a low-key character and a subtle beauty. That's a beauty you'll completely miss if you're in too much of a hurry. Josh Garrett Davis was raised in the region, and while he's relocated to New York and Philadelphia for his postgraduate studies, his memoir, called Ghost Dances, Proving Up on the Great Plains, serves as a tribute to the people and history who inhabit its vast, lonely spaces. It also explores how its sometimes heartbreaking history still has an impact on American life. Josh Garrett Davis, thanks for joining us today on Travel with Rick Steves.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, when we think of the Great Plains, we think of vast grasslands. And in your book, you give them dimension. And I mean, there's even nicknames for it. The handkerchief of the Lord, for instance, or the uncut hair of graves. Why would somebody say the handkerchief of the Lord?
That's a quote from Walt Whitman. And well, the most common image or metaphor that people tend to use is as an ocean of grass. That's one that's kind of become almost a cliche, but it's the more you think about it, you can keep going with it, and it actually keeps having more meaning. You can imagine yourself on the bottom of the sea, or you can imagine old homesteads as shipwrecks, and you can kind of keep going with it. The handkerchief of the Lord has to do, I imagine, that is with the texture of the land, that it, when you toss a handkerchief down, it's not actually flat. There's this texture to it that you can really, if you really pay attention to, you can enjoy it.
Now, we're talking mostly the grasslands, basically, of North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Kansas. Is that right?
Yeah, that's where I'm mostly focused. I mean, the plains continue down into Oklahoma and Texas and up into Saskatchewan and Manitoba,
right,
and eastern Alberta. But my book mostly focuses on the Dakotas and Nebraska and Kansas.
I like that notion, the uncut hair of graves.
Walt Whitman really, he knew what he was doing. Yeah, and there is a lot of life there. And even though it may seem dead, you know, like a graveyard, I think that's one of the gifts of having grown up there, is being attentive. Your senses become more attuned, I think, if you stay in a landscape that doesn't have any obvious mountains to stare at or something. And that when I came to the East Coast as a young adult, it was almost too much for me in some certain ways. Things are too loud, or people talk too fast and different things like that.
Yeah, now you wrote in your book that as a kid, you looked at the grasslands just as a dead brown straw, but then you gained an appreciation of that majestic ocean of grass. Tell us about your connection to the Great Plains.
Well, my connection has been severed several times. At my great-great-grandparents that homesteaded in Nebraska and some others that lived in Oklahoma, but then the families in the next generation or the following generation moved to either California or the East Coast, and then my parents, one from California and one from New York State, moved back to the plains, moved to South Dakota, which was not a very common thing to do then. So I grew up, I was born and raised there in South Dakota.
In your book, Ghost Dances, Proving Up in the Great Plains, you give a good historical background. Give us a thumbnail sort of overview from the Homestead Act and until modern times of the story of the Great Plains.
The Homestead Act was enacted during the Civil War to give everybody, anyone who applied, a 160-acre plot of land. And if you built a house and farmed it for 5 years, you got it free.
Is that what proving up is?
That's what proving up is, exactly. Hmm. And in South Dakota, particularly, we have a pretty complicated history because all of western South Dakota was part of the Great Sioux Reservation from 1868. But then gold was discovered in the Black Hills in, I think, 1874. And the government kind of nixed the treaty.
Wow.
And that resulted in the wars, including the Little Bighorn, where Custer met his end.
So now, were the bison sort of the same victims just like the Indians?
Yeah, a lot of people think of it as the bison being harvested for fur coats and things like that, but a lot of them were actually being killed so that the leather would be used as belts in factories before rubber belts were invented. And the bison herds are now growing a lot. There are about 250,000 after there were fewer than 2,000 head in around 1900.
We'll take listener calls in a moment for Josh Garrett Davis, the author of Ghost Dances, Proving Up on the Great Plains. Our number at Travel with Rick Steves is 877-333-RICK. Or you can follow up on anything you hear each week by posting your comments in the listener feedback forum. You'll find that in the radio section at ricksteves.com. Now, the situation today on the Great Plains is, are young people leaving the plains or are they staying there? What's the demographic trends these days?
Yeah, it's been slow and steady depopulation since the 30s, really, and since the Depression. And young people continue to keep leaving or concentrating in the cities there. You know, the big cities within or around the plains are growing, but the rural areas are just emptying out. Schools are having to consolidate and kids have to commute, you know, 60 miles to school or something. And
well, so the bison herds are being revitalized. Do you think the rural communities can be revitalized in a similar way?
Well, some may. The ones that can come up with new ways to exist. You know, it's tough with agricultural communities because farms and ranches have gotten so big, it's hard to have enough people, enough density to sustain a community. But places that have developed touristic things or places where there's a growing Hispanic community that's helping to revitalize certain towns.
The title of your book is Ghost Dances, Proving Up on the Great Plains. What are ghost dances and what does that have to do with the Great Plains today?
When we were just talking about the discovery of gold in the Black Hills and then the wars that followed that, ended up in a pretty destitute defeat for the Lakota Sioux tribes in South Dakota. And in about 1890, there was a religious revival that actually started out in Nevada, but it caught on really big with the Lakota. And it was a sort of religion that promised that if you did this dance, the ghost dance, that the bison would return and the whites would go back to Europe or disappear in some way, and that all would be sort of restored. And throughout the book, I kind of use it as another sort of theme that there are a lot of ways that we do ghost dances in our lives, whether it's on an individual level or like we were just talking about trying to revitalize a local community or try to build a main street back to where it was or to bring back the bison herds, which is actually happening in a much slower way than the ghost dance prophesied.
The ghost dance with Native Americans was to wish the bison would come back and the white settlers would go away. Is a ghost dance, is that a constructive or a destructive thing?
Well, it depends on your interpretation, because the whites saw it as very destructive and were very threatened, and the government ended up...
Well, that led to the Wounded Knee Massacre, didn't it?
The Wounded Knee Massacre, and so that was...
So the Sioux are dancing, hoping the bison will come and the white people will go, and the white people decide, let's go in and massacre 250 Sioux.
Yeah, they worried that it would turn violent. It wouldn't. Right. I don't think they believed that in the truth of the prophecy, but they believed that it would turn violent.
At the beginning of your book, you wrote, I left the Great Plains as soon as I could, but could not truly leave the Great Plains. Its culture or its mythology stayed with me. Talk a bit about that.
I think there's something about the sensitivity to the landscape and the enchantment. Whenever I go back, I just can breathe in a different way. You know, there's just the smell of the air. But then I also became, once I left, much more interested in the history and the myth of the plains and the West. And I started reading more books about it and watching movies and exploring these things. And it was a sort of way to reconstruct my home without being there myself.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're speaking with Josh Garrett Davis. And Josh's book is Ghost Dances, Proving Up on the Great Plains. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Barbara's on the line in Mill Valley, California.
Hi, it's been fun listening to Josh. I feel much the same way. I was raised in western Nebraska and then moved to California. And when I go back, I just feel like I can stretch. Mm. It's really quite wonderful. So yeah. I wanted to tell you about the Sandhill Cranes. Each spring, the Sandhill Cranes from the south, Arizona, Texas, that whole area, 500,000 of them funnel into a 75-mile stretch of the Platte River in Nebraska. So if you imagine an hourglass, this is the neck of the hourglass for the migration. It's the largest concentration in the world.
500,000 cranes coming at the same time?
Yeah, they come over a period of a month.
Okay.
And they stay about a month.
Whoa.
And they feed, they eat, they dance, they do courtship dances. These are big birds, too. They're like 4 feet tall with 6 foot wingspans.
It's incredible.
So in some, yeah,
to
it
see
is.
That. Now, you see that in Nebraska?
In Nebraska, in a 75-mile stretch, there's a town called Kearney. They pronounce it Kearney in Nebraska. And that would be kind of a center of it. The Audubon Society has a big festival there and places that you can watch them. I've read that there are as many as 12,000 per half mile.
So you could go to Nebraska if you wanted to in March to see the sandhill
yep.
cranes. And
yes.
Barbara, it sounds like you've been there. What else would you do in Nebraska that would be fun in a different dimension of Nebraska?
Right. People wouldn't probably think of wineries in Nebraska, but I've discovered that, much to my surprise, that they seem to be popping up all over the place.
I wouldn't think that. Are they good wineries?
They tend to be what they call fruit-forward wines, which would be what we think of often as German wines.
Huh.
I mean, it's a cold winter. But they're winning awards. Some of them have bed and breakfast.
Fine Nebraska wine. See that? Fine Nebraska wine. It's kind of an interesting thought, isn't it?
Yeah.
Give me a fine Nebraskan wine as I watch 500,000 sandhill cranes coming through the bottleneck there.
There is a winery that is an award-winning winery in that area.
Great.
Called Max Winery, I think.
Max Winery. All right, Barbara, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Okay. And Steve's on the line in Albany, Oregon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Like most people, when I was a kid, my family would take us on a family vacation, and our goal was really to get across Kansas and Nebraska as fast as possible to get to something more interesting. But, as an adult, we did the same thing. We took our kids, and eventually we decided that, maybe there's some interesting things here. And it's true, if you slow down, there's a lot of interesting sites in Nebraska and Kansas, not too far from Kearney, where your last guest mentioned. There's North Platte, and right there, there's Buffalo Bill at a ranch, which is pretty interesting to see. In Kansas, we actually spent some time camping in Kansas once near Dodge, and there were these wonderful fields we drove through of sunflowers.
Hmm.
And in fact, I think Kansas is called the Sunflower State.
And bought first, sunflower butter there.
If you spend a little time looking at and exploring, you can find quite a few things.
Now, they have Carhenge down in Nebraska, right? Where's
yeah.
that?
Mm-hmm.
That's a little northwest of where the Sandhill Cranes are. It's in a little town called Alliance.
Alliance. Josh, tell us about Carhenge.
Well, Carhenge is a pretty exact replica of Stonehenge, oriented the same way toward the sun and everything, and made of, I would say, 1970s-era American cars. Painted gray, and it's a wonder to behold.
A celestial calendar for druids and car aficionados. This is a Carhenge. There's other, what do you call these? In your book, you talk about purple cows. Talk about that.
I only recently learned this term, purple cows, as these sort of roadside attractions, and I think Steve's right that you need to slow down and take the two-lane roads and...
Right.
In Kansas, they have the world's biggest ball of twine.
Kansas has lots. It's got the Barbed Wire Museum in La Crosse.
Barbed Wire Museum.
Now, is that just about the end of the cowboy era or something, or what's the barbed
wire
museum?
Yeah, and all the different varieties. I think before barbed wire was standardized, there were an astounding variety of different types of points and that would keep cows together. Not too far from there is that world's biggest ball of twine, which I think there may be a dispute. There may be a couple of world's biggest balls of twine.
Steve, thanks for your call. I think we're going to go roll some twine here and get in the Guinness Book of Records.
Have fun.
Okay, thanks, Steve. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're speaking with Josh Garrett Davis. We're talking about his book, Ghost Dances, Proving Up on the Great Plains. Josh, for me, going to the Great Plains is part of just gaining an empathy or an appreciation for the struggle of the early pioneers. Where can you go to actually get a sense of that, to see the wagon ruts or understand what their challenges were?
It's amazing that those wagon ruts still exist 150 or more years later. And at Scott's Bluff National Monument out in western Nebraska, they have some of the wagon ruts that are there, and that was one of the sort of markers that people would kind of long to get to after just going across. Because we think, you know, if you're driving across Nebraska now, some people think, even on the interstate going 80 miles an hour, that it takes a long time. But imagine on in a covered wagon when it took days and days and days, and just to imagine getting to that landmark, that you were almost to Colorado, you were getting close to the mountains, you can kind of sense that the relief and try to imagine that in those those impressions that are still there in the ground.
And with all of the tumult and all of the struggles and the history there, when you think about Native Americans and you think about bison and you think about pioneers, what's your favorite historical site where you'd get a sense of that? What's most compelling for you?
Well, just north of Scott's Bluff, actually, there's a very sort of under-visited national monument. It's called the Agate Fossil Beds, and so it includes some agates and geological things, but it also has fossils, and it also has a collection of Sioux artifacts that a rancher from near there, I think, collected. And the thing about this monument is that it's way out there, and you just can hear the wind whooshing in your ears, and you might see a thunderstorm just kind of appearing in the west and just coming toward you furiously in this dark gray storm, or, you know, that it's just really, really far off of the beaten path, off of the interstate. I think those types of sites where you could look on the map and you see somewhere that's as far from a town as can be, that's, I would aim for there.
So you stand out there, the wind's blowing, the weather's overhead, you got the big sky. What do you see? What do you feel? What do you smell?
You feel the wind going across your face and over your ears. You smell the sagebrush and the grasses. You might spot a jackrabbit. And if you're in the right spot, you might see a bison. But most of all, you're going to notice the sky and how magnificently enormous it is.
Proving up on the Great Plains. Josh Garrett Davis, thanks so much for being with us. And next time I drive across Kansas or South Dakota or Nebraska, I'll give it a little better look, thanks to your book.
All right.
Ghost
Thanks
Dances.
A lot. Take the two-lane roads.
Take the two-lane roads.
All right.
Wisdom. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You got the big drum in the distance, the blackbirds in the sky. That's the sound that you hear when the buffalo cry. Outlaw the ghost dance. Outlaw the ghost dance. We shall live again. We shall live again. We shall live again.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Europe Through the Back Door in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, with Sarah McCormick and Isaac Kaplan-Wolner. Thanks to the Radio Foundation in New York and to WRTI Philadelphia for studio help today, and for website help to Kate Mulhern Graham and Andrew Wakeling. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. There's more in the radio section of ricksteves.com, including audio from the show that you can download to your smartphone or MP3 player, and web links to our guests. We'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Travel with Rick Steves is made possible in part by the European Union delegation to the USA. Tips about traveling in Europe and information about the EU are available at euintheus.org.